Welcome to the latest episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, December 21st. In this episode of Oncology Peer Review On The Go, we take a look at an article publishing in early 2021 from the journal Oncology. The article is titled Patient-Reported Outcomes of Pain and Related Symptoms in Integrative Oncology Practice and Clinical Research, Evidence and Recommendations. The piece summarizes current and validated patient-reported outcomes specific to cancer-related pain. More, the piece recommends commonly used PROs to be standardized to aid integrative oncology clinicians and researchers in both patient care and study design. For the first of two interviews regarding this piece, I spoke with three authors of the article, Drs. Iris Zee and Ting Bao from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and Dr. Shin Shelley Wong of the MD Anderson Cancer Center. So I was hoping you could give a brief overview of the piece and then some of the key conclusions you made, you know, and then also looking at what was the motivation behind pursuing that. We can start with you, Dr. Bao.
Sure. I'll give an overview of the motivation, and then Iris and Shelley can certainly talk specifically for this piece. Mm-hmm. So basically, from SIO standpoint, I'm the current president. So Society for Integrative Oncology is a multidisciplinary and international organization with more than 600 members. And our society started in 2003, and our goal is really, our mission is to promote evidence-based integrative oncology. A major piece of that is to promote integrative oncology research. And so currently there has been so many research going on, and there's certain lack of rigorousness in it. So, and one, two major problem I can see is one's the outcome. So there's so many different studies use so many different outcome measurements. So by the end, it's really hard to put them together to figure out a sort of meaningful message. So as a result, this, and another piece is statistics, which can be left for later. We really need a rigorous statistic analysis and plan for the trial. So for the first step, really as a step to kind of standardize integrative oncology research, one is focus on sort of standardized outcome measurement. And patient-reported outcome has been used in majority of the integrative oncology research. Because that's, in a way, that's what the field really focuses on, how patients feel. So that's actually the first step of from the research committee of SIO to really help standardize the patient-reported outcome. In this case, it's cancer pain. So that's why the committee met periodically, and we decided that, you know, we really want to put together a manuscript focusing on standardizing patient-reported outcome, focusing on cancer pain. That's the sort of the beginning of this whole manuscript.
Okay, I can give a little bit more word regarding why this paper is important. I'm a researcher, training background as a medical oncologist. So we've seen that cancer patients suffer from a range of many, many symptoms driven by both disease and their therapies. So cancer pain and fatigue probably ranked always number one or number two among all different kinds of cancer or therapies. So this is a very important issue, although the standardized management guideline and interventions available, but how this continues to imply that in the routine patient care is always a challenge. So for opioids related issues, they're well recognized currently. So there are many, many other research in this society which require more dedicated research going on. And we have a chance to develop some of a patient report outcome assessment tool. And in the history for just a pain assessment, there are over 200 something different tools. So especially for practitioners who need such tool to implement their research project, is always feel puzzled what what to do with that on the methodology consideration and so on, what is the choice, how to use it, how to interpret the data, and so on. So in this case, such paper is extremely important to guiding newcomers and everyone on the same page. So we could compare what you're doing, what I'm doing, the result from patient's report are comparable.
Yeah, that's, thank you, Shelley. That's actually a very important point for one of the reasons why we wanted to summarize available PROs in terms of cancer pain. And particularly, we wanted to highlight those PROs has been validated, they are reliable, and they're also easy for providers and the patients and the researchers to use. That is the really the fundamental goal of this paper. So in this article, we actually summarize the most reliable validated PROs, and I think they are both could be measuring the severity of the pain, the intensity assessment. We're also providing the PROs relevant to the symptoms burden associated with the cancer pain.
So you started to touch on the recommendations that you make in this piece. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what was behind the recommendations for each specific PRO you write about. And really, can you broadly discuss the implications of these recommendations?
Yes. So coming down to the recommendation from our work on this issue, we come down to realize, there are so many PROs out there, and then it's very difficult to, compare one versus the other one, especially when we're using the similar integrative approach, and then there are two different research results out there. And then for the readers, it's very difficult to understand how this the results is different from another, how exactly we should adapt to this in the future practice. So that's why we're trying to harmonize in a way in this area. The challenging is that, we're not able to rank them because each PRO has its own merits and their pitfalls. So we actually summarized the most highly reliable quantified PROs in these articles, and we actually select a highly used few. We listed them for our readers for their consideration. There's no really which one is the number one choice, which one's number two choice, but rather we want to give a very concise recommendation. So then, for example, if the readers not really sure the quality of the PRO used in the article they are reading, they could reference to this piece and then to see whether this is what's included and then what's the evidence behind that. So we actually was able to summarize the few just for the reference for our readers. In terms of for the pain intensity assessment, the brief pain inventory is one of the very well validated PRO, and it's probably the most commonly used around the world. So this is the one we recommend when readers consider to assess the pain intensity. When come down to the symptoms, associated with the cancer pain, there are multiple of them out there. We found a few probably will be the most common usually and validated and reliable. For example, the MD Anderson symptoms inventory, Memorial symptoms assessment scales. Another commonly used is called Edmonton symptoms assessment symptoms. And of course, NCI has developed the patient reported outcomes, the common terminology criteria for the adverse events, which is also commonly using in pain research and clinical trials. This is the 2020 is the COVID pandemic. Telemedicine has transformed how we practice in clinic, And then with this electronic PRO, we believe it provides a very unique advantage in this setting, because we can quickly assess patients' symptoms, cancer pain control, and then quickly we can facilitating the intervention. And the ultimate goal is to reduce the patient's unnecessary visit to the emergency room or the hospital utilization, and you know, reduce the COVID exposure risk. So I think in that aspect, electronic PRO also providing a very important advantage.
And so, kind of looking at the larger picture, for years in cancer care treatment, the primary goal has been to cure patients and to maximize progression-free survival. But as I have more and more of these conversations for the podcast, a trend that I've really noticed is that research is starting to emphasize quality of life. So I was hoping to ask, what do you think is behind this shift, and what role can further emphasis on PROs play in the continued focus on quality of life?
I'll start. I think the shift is really because right now the anti-cancer treatment has advanced so much. We have so many good options, and patients live much longer now. We have so many more survivors for much longer. So gradually, the quality of life is becoming more and more important, just because the survivorship is getting longer and longer. And in addition, if you have two very effective anti-cancer treatment, if one give you better quality of life versus the other, that's an edge over the other treatment. That can help the clinician to decide which treatment to go. So that's another reason quality of life research becoming more and more important. So what do you guys think?
So there are a long-term history for quality of life research that's in the social science and beyond the medical area. However, this qualified research in the National Society had deeper development, and in recent decade, more developed of methodology and research agenda on patient-reported outcome. So although the larger goal it is to improve patients' quality of life, but under this umbrella, the level of the things could be done, and the multiple levels all rely on patient reported outcome. So for example, under the umbrella of quality of life, in that is a health related quality of life. It's not really the patient's complaint of a financial burden or some other issue, unsatisfied life. So the health related quality of life, and the next level is their functioning, how their functioning related to their health status. And under the functioning is the patient's symptom. The symptom could be pain, could be fatigue, could be sleeping problem, could be depressed mood, could be poor appetite and not able to eat, and so on. So those symptoms impact on the function, and function impact on their health status, and the health status impact on their quality of life. So there are a schema for this from Professor Wilson, 1995 on JAMA. This whole picture provided a good guideline for people focus on different part of the issue. And on this paper, we focus on symptom, but that symptom is pain. So all the way impact from their functioning, health-related issue, the status, and the quality of life. So eventually our goal is to making the patient with cancer or survival from the cancer living better without symptoms, without compromised functioning, and achieve to maximum of their living quality of life.
So looking ahead into the future, how do you all see the role of PROs evolving as far as cancer treatment goes? And do you think care providers will start to integrate these more often into treatment?
So pain assessment is probably the first among all of the cancer-related symptoms for a whole side of a society adopted package from assessment to management. And so this guideline has been issued based on lots of research. And two of my colleagues here, they are practitioner, I'm not. But in the history, we observed the research agenda to prove how you're using appropriate assessment, you were reaching to the better outcome for patients.
I think the answer to this question is absolutely yes. I think about a few years ago, actually, FDA approved one of the JAK2 inhibitor for treating symptoms based on the PRO. They approved this drug. Basically, the drug developers designed a very careful clinical trial, and then they focus on the patient's pain symptoms associated with enlarged spleen. And then based on this clinical results, they actually successfully got FDA labeling for this drug treating symptoms rather than improving the survival. So I think definitely PRO has a role in drug development and potentially providing more effective interventions for our patient.
If that's it, I don't have any other questions. So thank you so much for your time, all of you. I really appreciate that and your insight on this article.
Thank you.
Thank you. Those are great questions. Thank you.
For this week's response perspective, I spoke with Dr. Linda Carlson of the Cumming School of Medicine at the University of Calgary. Carlson expanded on the work done by Zia and her colleagues, emphasizing the importance of understanding reliability and validity. Carlson also focuses on the importance of this article and the impact properly validated PROs can have on patients for the cancer care team and researchers of this topic. Dr. Carlson, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today to give your perspective on this review article that's publishing later.
Yeah, very happy to have the opportunity.
So I just really want to start with your general thoughts on the article. You know, if you could just provide maybe some of the points that stood out to you and some background for this piece, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm just really happy to see that mainstream oncology is embracing this field of patient-reported outcomes and really listening to the patient experience, especially when we're talking about something like pain, which really is a personal experience. There's no, scan you can do or measure pain without talking to the person about their experience. It's innately an internal sort of experience that there's no other way to get at. You know, you can, it's not always correlated with tissue damage or the specific interventions a person's been through. So within the broader field of medicine, oncology, integrative oncology, really it's been pleasing to see this embracing of patient-reported outcomes, patient-reported experience measures. And specifically within integrative oncology, I think this is especially important because the things we care about, the things we're trying to influence, are typically not those quote-unquote hard endpoints like survival, but our focus is on quality of life and pain and symptom management. And so we need to have really sound measures for those kinds of outcomes that are, responsive to change and that are reliable and valid. So part of what I wanted to talk about in this podcast just was around issues of reliability and validity, and maybe a little bit giving context to the history of measuring patient-reported outcomes that they're, called.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you wanted to go ahead and maybe get into some of the background and the history, absolutely go ahead.
Sure. In the paper, it cited a growing interest in patient-reported outcomes in oncology in the sort of 2000s, mid to late 2000s. But really, this goes back, well, in psychology, it goes back a century. It was after World War I that psychologists started to try to measure things like intelligence. It was in the middle of the century that we started to learn how to measure things like personality, and more relevant to medicine, anxiety and depression and these kinds of symptoms. And so there's an entire field of what's called psychometrics or test construction that has developed around the best, most accurate ways to measure these internal experiences that everybody understands, but they seem, soft, they're slippery. How do we actually get a handle on these? And so the principles from test construction theory have been applied to these patient-reported outcomes, which really are the same things, you know, and I've always kind of laughed a little bit, you know, when everyone's like, oh, we're doing patient-reported outcomes, it's a great new thing. And I'm like, this is not a great new thing, right? Psychologists, we've been doing this for a century and we're very good at it. You know, so I think it's important as this long history of learning and methodology is being transferred more into mainstream medicine, that people who may not have a background in psychology and test construction understand a bit what happens or what's behind developing good measures, you know, specifically for pain or quality of life or those other symptoms we're interested in, like fatigue, like anxiety and depression. I guess the other piece, and I will actually get into a little bit around, you know, what is reliability? What is validity? Really, you know, all the different types of it, because we toss these words around, you know, in a very casual way, but they have very precise definitions as well. You know, and the other, I guess, piece that I think is important to highlight is the work that's been done within the field of psycho-oncology to really bring to the forefront the patient experience. For example, this movement to recognize screening for distress or distress as the sixth vital sign in cancer care, you know, along with things like pain and with the other sort of vital signs, right? So blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, those sorts of things, so that we recognize the patient's experience, their experience of distress and other symptoms as just as important as those other medical vital signs we would measure. So I would, you know, hark back to the work by Jimmy Holland, the late Jimmy Holland, who was the president of the International Psycho-Oncology Society for many years, and the work that she and that organization have done to really bring to the forefront the importance of screening for distress, and so the measurement issues around that as well. And I actually see that as a precursor for this patient-reported outcomes movement.
So just rewinding quickly to a point you made in the beginning of your response, I wanted to get your thoughts on this idea of, you know, this practice being really emphasized a century ago and not really so much being emphasized again until the early 2000s. What caused this disconnect between the two time periods, and really what's the root cause of the reemergence now?
Well, that's a really interesting kind of sociology of medicine type of question, right? So we've got these parallel fields, and I guess part of the problem broadly is that everyone works in silos. Right? So psychology really until, oh, I would say probably the 80s, 90s, the field of health psychology and behavioral medicine became more integrated into mainstream medicine. But prior to that, medicine developed on a whole different track than psychology and even psychiatry kind of in the middle, right? But there wasn't a lot of crosstalk around, you know, how can we take what's been learned in one field and honed and developed? How can we apply this to another field? And I think that's a really common problem across different specializations within medicine, different disciplines, is this siloization and, you know, not having really contact with a lot of professionals from these other disciplines. And so the field of psycho-oncology, which again is a fairly new field, you know, integrates the expertise from psychology and social work and psychiatry, you know, around the human experience of cancer, you know, dealing with all these different symptoms and side effects and quality of life, and bringing that into mainstream medicine. You know, so I really do credit the field of psycho-oncology quite a bit for, you know, pushing ahead with this agenda. And then some very sort of forward-thinking people in medicine who recognize that, you know, we need to capture more than just disease-free survival, right, in our patients, because our patients care just as much about the quality of their life as the quantity in many cases. They don't want to live longer if they're going to be in miserable pain or they're going to be suffering.
And so you kind of alluded to which something that the authors really, really touch on. But at the end of the day, the goal really is to cure patients and improve quality of life. That's been the practice for a while. So how can accurately assessing patient symptoms, the impact of these symptoms on the patients, and really understanding the response of treatment impact these ultimate goals?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at if you look at a medical clinical trial, you know, and this is, I really give a lot of credit to people who design these trials for adopting quality of life almost at the same level, you know, as sometimes a primary outcome or a secondary outcome. Because if you're looking at, say, a second or third line chemotherapy treatment, you know, in an advanced type of cancer, it's just as important what effect that has on a person's symptoms and their quality of life as it is how many more months of survival they're going to get, right? Because if they have terrible neuropathy or pain, for example, you know, or they can't even get out of bed, they're so nauseous or so weak, a lot of people would prefer not to take that treatment. So having the knowledge of the effect of these treatments on these other domains is equally as important.
And I really think this is an interesting parallel for an episode we did recently on fertility preservation. You know, really the goal is for these patients to survive. But if you're not taking into consideration, you know, the quality of life of these patients months after, then it's really tough to kind of find that balance.
Yeah, and in broader survivorship, you know, people are living a lot longer after cancer treatments, right? So for example, yeah, you have a young person who isn't given the opportunity to, you know, preserve their eggs or, you know, maintain their fertility. They're not even given that opportunity. They're 25, they've got the rest of their lives to live, and that's been taken away from them without really much thought or choice. You know, that's really problematic.
So looking at the article specifically, the first question I wanted to ask you is, what is the significance of standardizing cancer-related pain PROs, and how could that help to guide clinicians and researchers, as the authors suggest in this piece early on?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we need to have good standardized measures so that we're all speaking the same language, right? For the simplest thing is to have normative data so that we can compare, for example, a patient who has a certain score, what does that actually mean, right? Where do they sort of fall in the spectrum of other patients undergoing the same treatment? You know, most importantly, I think, or maybe because I'm an interventionist, is to accurately measure the effects of the types of interventions we're developing. How can we do that if we don't have good measures, right? And maybe that takes me into the discussion about what makes a good measure.
Yeah.
And there's also another discussion I'm often asked, what measures should I use, right? And there's a number of things to take into account when you're working through that process. And maybe I'll talk about that a bit too. But I think we need to hone in a bit on these concepts of reliability and validity, right? So in the paper, the authors don't spend a lot of time on this. They talk about, yeah, these instruments are reliable and valid, but I think a lot of times readers may not have a very precise understanding of what those terms mean. So reliability really just tells you how accurately you're measuring whatever it is you're measuring. So reliability doesn't tell you what you're measuring. It just tells you how well you're doing it. And the two sort of main types of reliability we talk about are test-retest reliability. So if you give someone a measure, say a pain questionnaire, and it's got 10 items or something like that, if you give it to them and they get a certain score, if you give it to them again in a short period of time, maybe the next day, and you're not expecting any changes in their pain, how similar are those scores, right? They should be very similar. And that shows that the items are straightforward and they can't be interpreted a million different ways. So there's that sort of test retest consistency over repeated measurement. And then the other form of reliability you'll often see is internal consistency. And so that just means how well each item on the, say, 10-item scale, or how many items, how highly it correlates with all the other items. And so why that's important is that if you're trying to measure one construct, and so that's what we call these things, constructs, right? So pain is a construct, fatigue. So if you're trying to measure one, what you think is a unidimensional construct, then all the items should hang together. And so you want a high internal consistency. So those are the main two measures of reliability that just tell you how accurately are you measuring whatever it is you're measuring, right? Does this questionnaire get at the same thing each time, more or less? So you want a measurement that's reliably measuring your construct. But more importantly is the validity piece, right? So the validity piece is, so something's not just valid or invalid. Validity is a process, and it's also situation specific. So validity is really more about how well the tool measures the thing you're trying to measure, the construct. So how well does this tool measure pain, right? And there's different types of validity. So the most sort of simple is called face validity. So when people look at the items on the questionnaire, just anybody, a person filling it out or, you know, someone administering it, does it look like it measures pain? Does it make sense, right? Oh yeah, these questions measure pain. That's your face validity. That's important because people filling it out will be like, I'm not doing this if it doesn't make any sense to them, right? And that's sort of leads on to content validity. So it's a similar kind of thing. So if you have a conceptualization in your mind of what makes up pain as a construct, then you should ask those things on your questionnaire. So the content should be there. So if you think you need to know about the intensity of the pain, the duration of the pain, how much it interferes with other activities, then you got to have all that stuff in there as your content. But those two things, face validity and content validity, actually don't tell you too much about how it really behaves in practice as a questionnaire. Mm-hmm. So the next things we look at are things like, how does it behave in relation to other types of measures and constructs? So this would be your convergent and your divergent validity. So when you give the questionnaire to a person who's experiencing pain, say, and you give them other pain questionnaires, do they highly correlate? So do they converge? Do they come together? You would kind of expect them to, right?
Right.
Or do they converge with, you know, a diagnosis through a structured clinical interview, for example? And then the other things that are important are, for example, there's predictive ability or predictive validity, right? And so do scores on the pain measure predict things down the road that you would think they should? So if a person's pain is very high, maybe you think down the road, I don't know, they should be having more difficulty with mobility or activities of daily living. So does that actually pan out in practice with your measure? So does it predict what it theoretically should in the future? And then the issue that's really important when you're using it in an intervention, and this isn't as much validity, it's called responsivity or sensitivity, right? So how well does it actually respond to an intervention, this measure of pain, right? Because if you say you're using acupuncture or some kind of integrative oncology intervention that's supposed to improve pain, you want a measure that's going to capture that. So it needs to be sensitive to change. And that'll only happen if you have a measure that has variability, that doesn't have a floor effect or a ceiling effect, right? So for example, some measures like satisfaction, they always have ceiling effects. Everybody's highly satisfied. So there's no room to improve, right? And your distributions, statistically speaking, you need a nice normal distribution. You can't have skewed distributions. It's more difficult to see change. So that's a lot of things to consider, like a quick lesson in test construction. Yeah. But I think it's important for people to understand. Oh, and the other piece is that just because something is quote unquote valid or something performs well, it has good convergent discriminant validity or predictive ability in a certain population, it doesn't mean that's going to transfer over to another population. And that's a really important point, right? So a lot of these pain measures have been used in cancer patients, which is great, right? But maybe if you're working with a specific group, like a type of cancer or advanced cancer, you want to find measures that are specifically designed for that group or that have been used in that group.
So you kind of just alluded to maybe what could be a response for this question. But with all of this, if it is properly validated, what kind of insight can PROs give to, you know, not only researchers, but care providers and the entire cancer care team when they're working with a patient?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can learn a lot. So, for example, if you're using the same instrument across different studies, you'll have normative data, right? So you'll actually be able to compare your intervention or your sample with other samples all around the world, right? By using the same instrument. So if we give everybody, you know, the brief pain inventory in our institution, even as a survey, we can see, oh, look, people, you know, on average at whatever point in treatment, you know, right after diagnosis or after, you know, chemo or whatever, this is how much pain they're experiencing. Is this, you know, too much? Is this like usual? And so you've got those comparators that you can do, you know, with other groups all around the world. The other thing you can do is have actual clinical cutoffs, right? So in the paper, they talk a little bit about a 2-point decrease as being clinically significant change. And that's really important, right? Because you can see statistically significant changes on measures, but not know if that actually means anything for the patient experience. Right. And so being able to use these measures to come up with these cutoffs, you know, low, moderate, high, for example. So if your intervention takes people who have a high level of pain on one of these instruments and you can move them into a moderate or low category, then that's clinically meaningful. You're actually making a difference in the person's day-to-day experience. So these measures allow you to quantify that.
And so speaking of the brief pain inventory, the authors actually include that as one of their recommendations of PROs to use to assess cancer pain, you know, including the MD Anderson symptom inventory and the Memorial Symptoms Assessment Scale, among others. You know, they write that, quote, these tools are essential to the integrative oncology care team and should be incorporated routinely into clinical practice. I was hoping I could just get you to broadly discuss the implications of these recommendations and why the authors may have seen these as valuable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's really important to have these measures. Yeah, exactly. Routinely in clinical practice so that we can monitor over time what's happening with a person's symptomatology. So you know, people often ask, what measures should I use? And so the things like the MD Anderson, the Sloan Kettering, and the ESAS, those are multi-symptom measures, right? So they're a much more broad snapshot of where persons is on a range of different symptoms, you know, so you've got anxiety, depression, pain, fatigue, you know, other symptoms in there. And so you can have a snapshot of how they are right from the time you first see them, you know, and then following them at every visit over time. And, you know, there's very innovative programs that have been doing this, and they integrate it into the electronic medical record, and you can see a nice graph, you know, if things are going along, they're going down, or something spikes, right? And so you can see for each individual what their pattern of change has been by using these normative standardized kind of questionnaires. And I guess the next thing, and what usually happens in these screening for distress programs, is that there's associated algorithms, and these can be automated, right? So that when there's a spike in any of these symptoms, it's red flagged in the system and it's followed up on, and there's specific algorithms about where you refer the person depending on the symptom, right? So if they've got elevated pain, okay, they need to see a pain specialist depending on, again, what category of pain they're in. And you're able to categorize them with these types of instruments, say, oh, this is really severe pain, they better get a referral to a pain specialist. Or, you know, this is a more mild type of pain, maybe we can, you know, do some group psychoeducation or provide them some information on pain management, right?
Absolutely. And so looking ahead, really, do you see these kind of assessments being further integrated into the standard cancer care practice? And then if so, how do you see that being done?
Absolutely. You know, here in Alberta, where I'm at, we have a provincial cancer care system for everybody in the province. And it's been fully integrated into all our different cancer centers, so that kind of what I'm talking about, right? That each time a person comes in, it's just automatic that they're assessed on all these different symptoms and followed up on, right? So there's a requirement that the staff has to look at what's happening with these symptoms and all the different measures they get. We, you know, we use the ESAS and sort of standardized algorithms. And that way people aren't falling through the cracks, or it's not waiting until it's too late. You know, it's this systematic evaluation. You know, whereas clinical encounters in the past may have been more hit and miss, right? So some practitioners may check what's going on with pain, you know, and the other symptom related burden, but sometimes that would get overlooked, right? So this makes it systematic, so that it's just part of the cancer care experience, the continuum. It's integrated right into management of patients. It's really important.
And so lastly, really just looking at this overall and the field in general, is there anything that I haven't asked you here regarding this that you feel is important to share?
Well, you know, one thing I wanted to comment on is, and so we're talking about routine clinical care, but also in a research context, you know, I often get the question, okay, for my study of XYZ intervention, you know, what measure should I be using, right? And so there is no one size fits all. And I think that's an important point to make, is that, you know, the authors have outlined a really good list of different measures you can use for pain, but you need to look at age or specific population, so which measures have been used in that population, and then look at sort of the sensitivity of those measures, and also your type of intervention, right? So what's your intervention aiming to do exactly, right? And so you want to parallel as closely you can your measures with what you think your intervention's targeting, what it's going to improve. So are you going for quality of life? Are you going for mobility? Are you going for pain reduction? Are you trying to decrease the bother or the interference of pain, right? So say it's a mindfulness intervention, you don't necessarily reduce the pain, but you reduce the interference or the bother. So that's the kind of measure you'd want. Also, for whatever your primary outcome is, have a couple of measures and more multidimensional measures, right? So there's unidimensional measures like, you know, a 10-point scale type thing, but there's also these multidimensional measures that get at intensity, bother, interference, all that, right? So if it's your primary outcome that you're focusing on, measure it a couple of different ways so that you have, you know, that variability of data. You can really get the nuance of what your intervention's tapping into. If it's a secondary outcome, maybe just one shorter questionnaire, right? Because we have to take into account patient burden. So really, those are some of the things to take into account when you're choosing an instrument specifically to evaluate an intervention.
Dr. Carlson, this is all really great information. Thank you so much for lending your time to speak with me today on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I could go on forever. So thanks for listening.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.